So this is an activity that's organized by the NCN. I guess you know by now it stands for Network for Computational Nanotechnology. I don't know whether Jeff told you a little bit about it. Okay. Well, and I don't want to take very much time, but we have a mission to support computing in this very new emerging field of nanoscience and technology. So it's a mission to try to the name might lead you to believe we're all about supporting the computational community, but that's not really what we're about. We're about connecting it better to experimentalists and educators and designers and people who have problems to solve and want to use computation, and computational people who want to be better connected to experimentalists and people who are using their tools. So that's what our mission is all about. We consist of six universities and one Department of Energy lab, the Molecular Foundry. So this is an event co-hosted by Berkeley and Purdue. The other universities are University of Illinois, Northwestern, UTEP, Norfolk State, did I say Illinois, Northwestern? I think I've got six then. And we're fortunate to have six of the students from the NCN universities here, I believe five or six. So I don't know if they've been introduced. Okay, I know we have a student from Purdue, Phytos, and from Illinois, Yang. And I think I saw Elif from Berkeley. Are you representing Berkeley? Noel, are you from UTEP? Glad you're here. And are there any other NCN students that are with us? From Norfolk State? Northwestern. Okay, glad you're here. So, you know, let me give you a little bit of just a little bit of background and tell you what this meeting is all about. It's something that the NCN is just starting its second 5 years, and we're beginning to think through where we're going. And this meeting is the first step in helping us to think through where computing is going and where we should be going. And, you know, the background is I've heard several of you speak, and I thought you've had really interesting things to say. I've read a lot in science and computing, and most recently I read Leo's article, Excellence in Computer Simulation, which is the title of our workshop. And after reading that, I thought we all ought to get together and talk about these issues. And there are no breakout sessions, there's no report. It's just a matter of getting people together who have thought about these matters to have a good discussion and help us start to think about where the NCN is heading in the future. And actually, I hope we can stimulate a discussion maybe in the broader community and on our own campuses as well. So that's why we're taping and recording the presentation. So we hope that it'll be able to facilitate the dissemination within our network and outside of the network. So there were a couple of phrases that Norman used. You've heard briefly from Jim about the NanoHub. This is a science gateway that makes it easy for a person who has a piece of simulation code who wants to share it with collaborators. It makes it as easy as possible to do that without rewriting it in any way. And I think the way Norman's term, a social network linking developers and users, is exactly what the NanoHub is. It's intended to be a meeting place in cyberspace where if you have a problem to solve and you want access to some of the latest codes that are coming out of the research labs in these new fields for which commercial codes don't yet exist, it's a place where you can go and find them and the training material and get connected to the developers and where the developers can get connected to users. So we have a really broad group of people in the NCN. You know, we have people that work in HPC and Sirius software, and we have people who are developing tools and developing the next generation of CAD tools for this field. And we have a group of people that are working really side by side with experimentalists on the latest science and trying to understand it and how to turn that into technology. Very frequently they're working and using MATLAB and developing new theory and working on problems for which we're not even sure that we can trust the experiments yet or what the next step is, and every week there's a new experiment to explain. And we're trying to keep up with that work, and we felt it was useful to get this broad spectrum of people into one organization. And there have been some challenges in that. I find, you know, Jim alluded to the difficulties in people who work at the ab initio level in connecting with engineers who are building devices. There seems to be an impedance match there. But, you know, within the NCN, we have computational people who work very closely with experimentalists, who are very well impedance matched to them, but who also understand computation and more serious issues, more serious software issues. So the hope was that by getting all of those people together into one organization, we could help those that want to be better connected to the problems and applications do so. And that's really how the speakers were selected. If you look at the list of speakers, we have a computational chemist. We have a really broad cross-section, a smattering here and there. You've seen three broad perspectives today from science and engineering and Norman's perspective as editor of a journal that covers both. In the next session, we have representatives from industry, a colleague who has recently been in industry, an experimentalist, and then we have perspectives that come more from a serious HPC and high-performance computing and software perspective. And at the end of the session, we have a group of speakers that are really working on specific areas of science, electronics, and material science, and chemistry. So that's how the meeting was all put together. That's what we're all about. I've enjoyed the discussion so far. I think we have a break scheduled, but the things are pretty loose. If you know, we probably could go another 10 minutes and just continue the discussion that was started here. So I'd like to ask, you know, does anybody have any points of discussion, that thoughts that were triggered by our first three speakers that you would like to raise at this time? If not, I've got one or two, but I'll ask you first. Yes.
High performance computing in the context of undergraduate education. High performance computing generally turns out tons and tons of data, and we do not presently have readily available tools for analyzing that data. That means that the undergraduate student gets much involved in the nuts and bolts of doing the computation, but little involved in the interface between that computation and the rest of the world. I think this is wrong. Interfaces are all in computational science, and that I wonder whether we're ready for HPC for undergraduates.
Interesting. Any thoughts?
Well, I think it's arguable. But I think it's also unresolved because this one example, again, it's, you know, it's a tiny fraction. That woman first was working on the nuts and bolts piece, but later she graduated to getting into the physics. And I don't know how that happened because I don't know the details. And maybe N equal one is not a good argument for this.
Also, generalizing across scientific workloads or disciplines is difficult. For instance, if somebody who works a lot with undergrads and graduate students doing computation and molecular dynamic simulation at very, very large scale won't necessarily yield the other sort of data problem in that regard. So it's not all hopeless.
So I totally agree with your viewpoint. In fact, I was going to bring that up in my discussion, that one of the big issues that's going to come up is data. Some tools are starting to be developed. I'm not sure that they're ready yet for the undergraduate level, but certain visualization tools are starting to get to the point where they can handle some very large data sets. Now, the analysis that I think you're alluding to are more statistical and trying to understand patterns and features in large data sets. You're totally right. We're not ready yet, even I think at the graduate level. So, but I think it's an issue that needs to be addressed at a certain level.
I think you could make an argument that if not the most important, then certainly one of the most important applications of high-performance computing at the undergraduate level is in teaching physical principles and in illustrating and visualizing physical principles. These things, in my experience, are incredibly powerful at helping students really understand how things work. And so if we can infuse simulation examples, and we can infuse visualization of things. We saw a couple of examples this morning of this. And if you can infuse these kinds of things in undergraduate curriculum, not in specialized computing courses, but in all the courses we teach, I think that there's a huge opportunity there to effectively be more efficient at teaching undergraduates principles of science and engineering.
I think I agree with you that it provides wonderful opportunities for teaching tools. Those are very expensive tools, or can be. The simulations can be extremely expensive, but they are very good tools for teaching. That, however, doesn't mean that we should let the undergraduate, encourage the undergraduate to get up to his or her elbows in doing the scientific computation on blue gene, whatever it is.
An HPC doesn't have to be 10,000 processes, right? It can be 16 processes, 32 cores, and now you, instead of waiting for an hour for a result, you get a result in five minutes or 3 minutes, and suddenly you capture something that you couldn't have kept the attention of a person to other than canning a result and then showing a video or something, right? Or the thing of optimizations that you might run, and you can run them on 64 CPUs rather easily.
Right.
And it could be high productivity computing, not just high performance, the very highest end computing.
So let me ask a question. Okay. Don't I have a prerogative as the moderator here? Go ahead.
Hey, but I mean, over here. No, I'd like to comment with regards to this issue. Insofar as even at the research level, it can be very difficult to take the results of very large-scale calculations and make those amenable or appreciable by those who are not in the particular area. So we're talking about something which I think Jim talked about earlier, namely the capability of having the infrastructure to enable this to happen even at the higher level, much less now at the undergraduate level. I've been in this business a very long time, and that is one of the very serious concerns that still exists, and I don't see any ramifications aside from bigger grants, and how you get them to cover these kinds of costs is unclear. Thank you.
Okay, sure. I think there's been several comments about the value of simulation as an educational experience in the classroom. I think, and of course, that's part of the reason we built this NanoHub, to make it as easy as possible to get for students to get access to these tools. But I want to ask you a question, Jim. You probably know Ron Rohrer. And I remember reading an article. This is a fellow who was involved in some of the early work on circuit simulation programs. And he talked about how with the advent of SPICE, he thought this was going to have tremendous impact in education because students would be relieved of the burden of writing, you know, circuit equations and solving simultaneous equations, and they would get insight. And he concludes that he was completely wrong, that the use of the tool in the classroom basically didn't lead to additional insight. It led to brute force, trial and error. And so my question is, is it easy to impart insight and understanding? Do we know how to use these tools in the classroom? Are students really learning?
Well, I think you can, like anything else, you can use these tools in really good ways, and you can use them in ways which don't help the educational process. And part of what we're going through right now is learning, you know, which ways of using these things are actually really effective and which ways are not. But I can cite a bunch of examples, you know, where people, faculty at Stanford and other places that I know, have used simulation capability in a classroom environment at the undergraduate level. And the comments of the students and so on, in terms of how they understood the physical principles involved, were really supportive of the computational methods that were used. And I mean, you can teach them optimization. You can also teach them about statistical variation effects. And for example, you know, show them if they run Monte Carlo simulations, for example, that they don't get the same result every time, which is an interesting thing when they think about manufacturing variations and the spread of parameters in real world situations. And you can actually simulate these things in a very effective way. So there are places where it can be very helpful.
I just want to italicize something here. I think what I didn't mention in my presentation was that there's been a lot of research in about how students, as well as grown-ups, think about scientific concepts and their work. I mean, how the mind works in it. And none of this is really, it's almost in physics. We did it very early. It almost is all done at the introductory course level, you know, working on that. And I think that some of that needs to be done at a more advanced level, and it shouldn't just be limited to academics. We ought to be looking as part of the clientele that we research, people that work in industry. I think that one of the things that would lead to this is for engineering and physics to work much more closely together in these things. And I welcome that. That's what I'm hoping to find out a little bit more about how to do here.
Okay. Jeff, and then over here.
I would echo what Jim said about spice and really maybe even make the comment even more strongly. You know, in the discussion that's been going on about how to incorporate computing, you know, organically into an educational curriculum, you know, spice is really the poster child for that. It isn't even a matter of discussion, in my opinion, as to whether or not introducing spice into, you know, undergraduate circuit courses improves insight or doesn't improve insight. You can't teach a circuit course, an undergraduate electrical engineering circuits course, without spice. It's just
so I would agree with that, but I would urge you to read Ron's article, because he taught circuits before spice and he taught circuits after spice, and it really is food for thought.
Well, I haven't read the article, and I'll try to track it down, but you know, my sense is it may not be that spice is the issue here. Circuit design is done, you know, it's an indispensable tool of circuit design, and it's taught at almost the lowest levels in undergraduate classes. Just to emphasize that point, just on, you know, on the generalization, I think the way that particular computational tool sort of evolved and it became organically embedded in, you know, the way that people think about education of circuit designers is, you know, I think it's a good example and to follow for the use of computational tools in, you know, in be integrated organically into other topics, other courses, other subjects.
So as engineering professors, we need to teach our students how to use the tools that they're going to use probably for the rest of their careers. And I think we all have the feeling that this can help the educational process, but I have the feeling it's more difficult than we think. That the crafting of an educational experience so that the student really benefits from that is something that takes a lot of thought and care, and that maybe we need to spend some more time on. Was there a question over here?
Comment. I guess this is the computational chemistry wing on this side of the room. That's what I do also. I was a little intrigued by your comment, Professor Plummer, on integrating computational tools into the curriculum. I think chemistry in some ways led the way on the atomistic side with tools like Gaussian, which are widely available commercially. And I am aware of a few chemical engineering departments in particular that have courses devoted to that kind of simulation. So I guess I wouldn't fully agree that there isn't a place for courses that are devoted specifically to introducing students to specific computational tools. I'm not an engineer, but I kind of work on that border between chemistry and chemical engineering, and I've found in the problems that I work on that very often we simply don't have the fundamental data that are needed to even start a model, an engineering model. So I think students need to learn that there are ways to get that data in a reliable way, and they need to get experience with these things so that they're comfortable with them.
I agree with you that there are discipline-specific tools that the students in chemical engineering or other fields need to understand deeply, because they'll end up using them throughout their careers. But there also are a set of foundational principles, you know, that have to do with computational mathematics and how one thinks about discretizing a problem and solving things on a grid and things like that that are foundational. And those, I think, ought to be taught or are probably better taught as sort of a general course for all engineers. You know, we don't need to have a course like that in chemical engineering and a course like that in mechanical engineering and so on, because it's like math and physics and chemistry. I mean, engineering schools don't teach math and physics and chemistry because they're foundational. We rely on physicists, we rely on chemists, you know, to teach these classes. And then when we get into the discipline-specific things, then we do house them in specific departments. The interesting thing here is that one could think about math departments as teaching the basis of computational mathematics, but at least in my experience, I don't know any math departments that are even interested in doing that, much less capable or willing to do it. And so it's the breakage here is that we don't have a basic department to go to like we do for chemistry or physics or biology even. And so engineering schools end up trying to figure out how to do the computational mathematics in the engineering school itself.
Well, actually, I think that the same applies for this kind of ab initio computation as well, because a lot of chemistry departments don't have any interest in teaching that either. So it's often the engineering schools that have to come up with the courses on their own.
Yeah.
One more question, and then we'll take a short break.
Okay, I'll make it brief. But I actually wanted to come maybe full circle off of education and back to the research. And I had a question for Leo. In terms of how you ended by talking about how theorists and experimentalists really have to work together, and also you touched on the different roles that a theorist can play, where you're sort of an in-house theorist for the experimental group, but you need to be honest about what you're doing. Or maybe you make predictions in a completely new area and try to generate motivation. But the question I have is, there's this tendency towards large coalitions nowadays of broad interdisciplinary funding for many groups to come together. And what's your opinion on a good working model for how the theory gets integrated in these larger groups, which are perhaps mostly experimentally based, in the sense that you embed a theorist in each experimental component, you have a theory group so that they can overlap with each other most and then kind of branch out, or what works best, in your opinion?
My favorite experimentalist has on the door of his laboratory where theories come to die. A certain division of labor and a certain skepticism about what's done by one's colleagues is very useful for not getting into the pitfalls that science and engineering can provide. You can't be there as a scientist and do a service role. You have to maintain some independence. You have to spend some time yelling at each other that you're totally wrong. And you have to be able to have an interplay between one kind of scientist and another. It has, in my opinion, been too often true that the computational scientist served as a servant of an experimental program, of basically publicizing the work by producing pictures. It is also too often true that the experimentalist has been asked to design his or her experiments to provide a basis in validation or verification of the computer program. Both things are travesties of what science is. Science is independent minds working somewhat competitively and very critically to find the truth.
Okay. Great. We have a good discussion starting. So I think we have a short break here, and then we'll reconvene at 11 and continue the presentations.